She speaks of a linguistic apartheid in her country where Irish is the language of the people, but all but about 1% of the people speak English. I'm Susan McGuinness for Conversations. On this edition, a woman who is perhaps the most celebrated Irish poet writing today. Her name is Nuala Nagano. Welcome, Nuala. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Susan.
I want to ask you about this concept of linguistic apartheid. A scholar writing about you wrote that in this metropolitan world of languages, Irish is hermetic at best and inaudible at worst. Can you use that thought to take us into this notion of linguistic apartheid?
Well, you see, even though Irish Gaelic, but we call it Irish just to insist that it's, you know, it is central, even though Irish is the first national language in our constitution, it's the first language of the state, it has been associated with a very repressive form of teaching method, the way it's been taught in the schools, and then a lot of people don't have it at home, and a lot of people end up after, you know, 14 years of schooling with a real bad hang-up about Irish. They feel that they have personal failures at it, and therefore they blame the language. Or if they don't blame the language, it's something that they are feel shameful about, and they want to bury it quick and get away from it. And there's it's like a psychic hot spot in the psyche. You go near it, it's like a funny bone. You touch the language issue, and the whole country, you know, just becomes galvanized.
You have said that Irish is the sea and English is the land. What happens to people separated from language?
Well, yes. That's a basic metaphor in my work. I wrote a poem about a mermaid years ago, and I actually thought I was writing about a mermaid, but years later I decided it really was about language change. You know, the community, Irish-speaking community, out of which my mother came, for instance, and which I grew up in for a few years when I was small, the idea of the individual hasn't quite percolated up out of the community yet. You know, it's the whole community speaking the language, and it works like a great, how will I say, pulsating amoeba. The community does, and it's quite extraordinary. And to come from this wonderful, pulsating, you know, amniotic fluid up into the middle class, middle age reaches of the professional life, as my mother did, for instance, must have enormous psychic consequences that have never been expressed, and that's what I'm trying to write about.
All that is left behind.
Well, my image was the image that I'm trying to write a book about it now. I've invented a tribe of mer people who come up on land, and I was always, as a child, fascinated by the Hans Andersen story of the Little Mermaid, and of course now with the Walt Disney version, now that's kind of well known. But what I'm writing is definitely not under the sea. It's it's a rather more jaundiced view of the whole thing. One of the lines in that used to always strike me was that she said, when her tail was cut off and she had these legs, that every step she took was like 1,000 knives were going up through her. And I was so struck by that. And it's like a kind of a, if you have had a language and then you for whatever reasons leave it behind, whether because of emigration or ethnic cleansing or some other kind of trauma, have to leave it behind and make your way in another world. It's as deep a trauma, I think, to your identity or to your psyche as losing your body image. You know, if you had a tail and suddenly your tail was cut off and suddenly you've got these two bits of legs or something, and you don't associate them with yourself. I mean, that's the imagery I'm using. But I mean, it could be, it may not just be language change I'm talking about. I read these for the American Academy of American Poets in New York, and it was a mostly Jewish audience, and they came up to me afterwards and they said, "It's about the camps, isn't it?" And I said, "Well, you know, well, if you insist." But what I mean is that trauma and denial, say, especially, is what I'm really writing about, and no people or class has a monopoly on that. I mean, we all, you know, every people in some way has had a painful history.
Nuala Nagano, talking with us on Conversations. She is a poet who writes exclusively in Irish. Tell me how it happened, when it happened in your life, what said to you, Nuala, write in Irish. English is not your language, even though English is your first language.
Yeah, well, basically I'm bilingual. I'm, you know, basically bilingual. My first literary love really was the 18th century poets in Irish, and I learned off reams of them that were never on this course in school, and you know, I just loved them. But they didn't seem to have much to do with our lives. I mean, this was the 60s, and sex, drugs, and rock and roll, I want to put it mildly.
Everywhere.
Yeah, everywhere. And Ireland was no different. Maybe it was a few years later, you know, it hit Ireland, but it was the same. And you couldn't see how this wonderful stuff from the 17th, the 18th century in Irish connected with your life. But by actually the act of writing, we made that connection, me and a few more of my generation. And I remember, actually, I was 16, I was in boarding school. I was looking out the window, supposed to be doing my French exercise and actually writing a poem in Irish, which is what I did a lot of the time. And I was writing this poem, and there was something wrong with it. And it reminded me of a writer in Ireland called Austin Clarke. Now, I didn't even like Austin Clarke. Now, there's another Austin Clarke who's a Canadian writer, a prose writer. That's not him, but this is a poet in Dublin. And I wondered, why is this happening? And then I realized that what Austin Clarke had done was he'd brought the rhythms of Irish into English in his poetry. He wrote in English, but the rhythms of Irish, the prosody of Irish, the half rhymes, the intonation patterns of Irish were in English. And I thought, so I'm writing Irish poetry in English. That's a bit stupid, isn't it? So why don't I write Irish poetry in Irish, which I can do too? And I did, and the poem was noticeably better. And it got published in the Irish Times, and I was only just 17 at the time, and it won a prize, and it all went to my head, and I never looked back.
Was there no looking back? Was there no point where you said...
Oh, there was. Oh, yeah, I mean, I had a rather checkered career after that. I fell in love with a Turk and went off to Turkey and stayed there 7 years and wasn't going to set my foot in the benighted island of Ireland again. And...
Were you writing in Irish while you were living in Turkey?
Actually, I was.
And learning Turkish?
That happened first. I had a culture shock for the first 2 or 3 years. And then after I'd been there about three or four years teaching English as a second language, I got a bit bored with it all. You know, this is a book, is this a book? If this isn't a book, what's a book, you know? What is it, you know? You can only do so much of that, I felt. So I started writing poetry in Irish again. And yes, I did manage to write poems, you know, from the Anatolian night that I may not have been able to write if I had stayed in Ireland.
Uh-huh. Stepping away gave you something to look back to.
Oh yeah, very, very much. And it was only then that I realized the strength of the oral tradition that I had come up from. Because, you know, it was something like water all around. You didn't think about it, and it wasn't taught in schools, and it was very looked down on, and it was kind of sort of frowned on and considered not important. But in Turkey, there was another oral tradition, and I just switched from one to the other very relatively easily and loved it. And it gave me a kind of a take on our own stuff that I wouldn't have had if I'd stayed at home. Mm-hmm.
A question about looking back I want to ask you is about speaking to 1% of the potential readers. Did that ever give you pause?
Oh yeah, you know, you realize it's neither profitable nor fashionable. And say, I wish I could be a poet in English, but I'm not. Somewhere along the line, probably very early, before the implications of it struck me that, that had been set. I think I may be diglossic in that I use English and Irish for different functions. I use English for discursive, you know, linear thought, mm-hmm. and I use Irish for the rest of it, which is, after all, 9/10 of the personality, which, you know, there's a lot going on there.
Yeah. That's a nice way to put it. Nuala Nagano with us on this edition of Conversations. I want to ask you to read for us, but I think first, so that people will understand, we have to look at the issue of translation. Did translators come to you, or did you go to translators?
No, initially they came to me. I mean, I met a lot of modern poets in Ireland through translations. Paul Muldoon, who is now a very good friend of mine, how I ever got to meet him was that this letter came in the post with big handwriting in Irish, and it said, I have great respect for your work, and I have taken upon myself to translate this poem. I said, who's this so-and-so?
What's he doing in my life?
Yeah, yeah. And then I read the translation and said, It was so good. I said, who is this so-and-so? So then I walked out and it said, Paul O'Muldoon. I said, Paul O'Muldoon? Who's Paul O'Muldoon? Ah, Paul Muldoon, of course. He had written his name in Irish, you see, so then I said, oh, no wonder it's so good.
He's an Irish poet.
Yeah, an Irish poet in the English language, and a very good one. Yeah. And I said, oh, I wrote him back and I said, thank you very much, but I think this is great. And then we started corresponding, and then eventually we met at some reading where he was reading, and, you know, we went on from there. But a lot of the translations initially came like that.
Yeah. He said, I wonder first if he was very nervous when he sent that off to you. A woman who writes exclusively in Irish and scorns the English language for poetry, and here he is offering an English language version of her poem.
That never dawned to me. Mm. I'm so aware of the precariousness of Irish that I don't feel that we have any moral high ground or something by using Irish. I mean, I think that's a load of nonsense, and people may feel insecure about Irish, but really that's their problem. They have to get on with it with themselves. But I don't think it gives us any, you know, moral high ground just because we write in Irish. It's just a fact that we write in Irish.
That's, yeah, the way it is. Paul Muldoon's translations have been described as reinventions through the voice of Paul Muldoon. So when I am reading your poetry in the collection, The Astrakhan Cloak, a reviewer said, I'm reading Nuala Nagano, but I'm reading Paul Muldoon's poetry as well. Is that a comfortable awareness for you that this monolinguist over here is reading only one part of your poem?
Yes, because you know that these are translations, but what it bothers me is when people accept the translations as the real thing and it's suddenly it doesn't dawn on them that there's across from the page, I insist on a dual language format. Yes. Some people sort of lift the poems out of context and leave the Irish behind, and that bothers me, and I get upset then. But otherwise, you know, so long as the Irish is always there, I don't really mind, because the Irish poem is my baby.
Yes.
The English poem is like, you know, a foster child that you're given on loan, and that, well, I suppose you're giving your own children on loan too, but, you know, still, this is a metaphor. is a kind of a foster child, and then after a while, these children say, bye-bye, mommy, and they walk the world, and you say, you know, good luck.
Yes.
And not really anal retentive about them, you know.
Healthy, I suppose, especially since there's a translator in your world. Yeah. Will you read for us and I don't know whether to suggest or just ask come to your mind.
Well, I was thinking of doing Keshnetangan, which was the language issue, which
is
a sort of...
That's what I was hoping for.
Really, my political manifesto, in the sense that, you know, it was a squib, first of all. I was in the middle of writing something else when it just came to me. And sometimes they're the best poems, but sometimes, because you haven't worked very hard at them, or so you think, you kind of just sort of throw them off. And
couldn't be much if it came so easy.
Yeah, but actually, you know, that can be wrong. This poem was obviously growing inside me for years, and when it found the right moment, it kind of popped out. But again, Paul Muldoon is the translator. He translates it as the language issue. I place my hope on the water in this little boat of the language, the way a body might put an infant in a basket of intertwined iris sleeves, its underside proofed and with bitumen and pitch, then set the whole thing down amidst the sedge and bulrushes by the edge of a river, only to have it borne hither and thither, not knowing where it might end up, in the lap, perhaps, of some pharaoh's daughter. And I'll read it in Irish. Keshnetangan. Quirim ogochus ar snav imodin tangan, fe mor lagfon ni anon ni glivon, a vech fit of wit of the yellow felestrum is bitumen is pick ve kimilter len a horn. An son ne lagashis a masning elkach, is quigil na man she let hev na hawan. Fiachent, na the rish, kadur higan strahe. Fiachent, the olivish, and vorig inin arun. You can hear the differences in the languages there. You can hear how Irish is somehow, from the point of view of sound, very, very rich. You've got a double consonant system. You've got a double, you've got long, a whole, you've got, you know, five long vowels and five short vowels. So you've got a very rich palette you can play with. And sound plays, I think, a bigger role on the whole in Irish, even nowadays, than it does mostly in modern poetry. Though I do think sound is a very important part of all poetry, and it would be a pity to forget that in any language.
And can Muldoon and do other translators search for that richness of sound as well as
richness of... I think they do. I think definitely Paul does. And what he does also is that he has all these half rhymes, which is how Irish works. Irish doesn't abominate end rhymes and full rhymes, but it's all done assonantly, with assonance, with half rhymes. And then he does it like, with the edge and sedge and... I can't... What's more of the obvious ones? Oh, yeah, where it might end up, in the lap, perhaps. You've got a half rhyme between perhaps. Up and lap. That's very refined and clever. Really, that is giving the idea of the original. And I'm very pleased when that happens.
And so in some ways, this is quite exciting. There are two poems in your poem. And one is Paul meditating on and fulfilling your poem in a different way.
Oh, yes, and I'm very thankful to my translators, because you can't order a translation like you order pizza, you know. It's an act of love. Oh, really? I mean, a person cannot... I think if somebody translates something under duress, it shows, you know, the heart goes out of it. But if somebody, like in the original poem that he sent me, kind of offered it to me like an offering, it was because he loved the poem that he put so much hard work into it. Because it's very hard to translate, and it's a great sort of... act of love, really. So I'm very, very thankful to my translators.
In this poem, the language issue, there is a Moses set off in this little boat, having, as you described it in a discussion, the option of being cleaved in half before his mother, or perhaps drowned in this boat. Is this, connect this with this language of yours. You set this off in a very delicate way, knowing...
Yeah, the poem in a way is I'm Moses' mother, and the poem is the basket. And the language, or even my hope for the language, is in the basket. And then the reader actually has to play the part of Pharaoh's daughter if they want to. And I mean, I think that's fair enough, because I do think that the writing has a dual, there's a very much a dual thing in it. There's the writer and there's the reader, and they're the only important people. And critics and all these people are a load of nonsense, to getting in the way. They're just garbage, you know, quite honestly. But writers and readers are very important. And they are of equal importance, I think. I really do think, I expect the reader to do a bit of hard work too, you know. So that's why poetry is sometimes hard to read. You may not understand it perfectly the first time, but I think that's really no harm.
The Chinese-American poet Amy Tan says readers must know why they read, and writers have to talk about why they write in order to make that bond and that connection. So we kind of all know why we're in this business of words together.
Yeah, but the reasons can change, because a lot of the reasons may be unconscious. Both cases, I don't think it's as easy as that, but I do think it's important to ponder these imponderables, to think about these things. Yes, a lot of the motivation might be subconscious. A lot of the motivation to read might be subconscious. It's that looking for something you don't know what it is, a searching for something that. It's missing in your life, or something, a kind of definition that you sort of hope is there, but maybe it isn't. Even if it's just a freeze frame of a one moment of sensation, which sometimes poems are, but even that's enough, because otherwise chaos is so overwhelming that we might go under.
Right. Yes, I think I was thinking of a characterization of, in reading, giving the opportunity for something to happen, something new to come in, some awareness to come out, some confusion to be resolved, or some resolution to get confused. I mean, something to be stimulated.
Well, it is a creative act, and reading is very much a creative act, but writing is a creative act too. I know now you've got all this sort of, this new Lacanian, the Derrida stuff, and it's as if the writer isn't important anymore. But that's wrong too, I think. I mean, granted, the reader is important, the writer is very important too, and the presence of the writer. That's why poetry readings are something that I feel are part of the job description. I wasn't really a natural performer, but I've taught myself to kind of do the poems justice, at least. Because I do think that that's something that we're maybe beginning to lose, the sense of the presence of a voice. you know, even if you read the book in silence on your own, you should hear a voice of some description inside in your head. And sometimes a poetry reading can amplify that voice and also make it more accessible to a lot of people, and then they can go home and enjoy the books more.
Right. And it definitely puts the human in the picture. We have so many things that are mechanized, movies and TV and even radio and compact discs, things that we slots.
That's true. And often poetry is seen like a kind of a cultural muzak, you know, it's a sort of a especially Irish language poetry. I mean, I'm a token bit of token exotica, you know. I'm trundled out for all the world like something from the tomb of Tutankhamun, you know, in cultural occasions, you know. I swear, that's what I feel like. And I resist that. That's not right.
Yeah.
You know, this is a perfectly intellectually credible way of being in the world. And I challenge anyone to challenge me on that. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to keep the presence alive.
Do you feel a kinship with, there are languages that are slipping away all around the planet. Do you feel a kinship with?
Oh, very much so, yeah. That's why, really, one of the reasons I'm here. I spent yesterday foraging in the Institute of Alaskan Languages, Native Languages, and I just came back with such wonderful stuff. I'm going to bring them all back to Ireland now and read them aloud to my friends who are Irish storytellers. And I tell them, you know, this is the kind of storytelling they have in Alaska. I'll read them in English, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But I'm going down there today to hear the tapes of some of the stories. Because even if I don't understand the words, I have the English across the page. And I do think that something comes across which is beneath meaning in language. Something, I don't know, some sort of, it's a calling up of depths within us. And that can cross boundaries. I mean, I've often been sort of, the years I lived in Turkey, I've often been up in the middle of the night and with the radio on, and I'd listen to Ilahis from Riyadh, you know, and these are all Arabic prayers, and I don't know what they mean, but they sound extraordinary, and the hair in the back of your neck stands on end. And that can, you know, that, and I don't understand the words, and that's a level of language that I'm very interested in. Though I do think meaning, of course, is very important, but I don't think it's the be-all and the end-all.
Somehow that internal landscape that you talk about that is the universe of your writing is a universal internal landscape.
Oh, well, I hope so. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm only human, so.
You've talked about the internal landscape as...
I called it a ghastly continent once. I was in a bad mood that time, obviously.
That's very nice. It's something, and I don't have this right, I can't get it, but it's something about the original existence, that the internal landscape is what gives us access to whatever our original existence is, the one that's covered up by clothes and fashion and jobs and outward things.
Yeah, maybe that's my last illusion, you know? Maybe that's the fact that I think there may be such a thing is the last illusion. But it doesn't matter. I think you have to have enabling myths. Otherwise, you won't get up in the morning, you know? Even if this is just an enabling myth, I'm prepared to go with it. That there are layers and layers of us that we have been trained out of, and they're like these phantom limbs, you know, like, you know, the mermaid who got her tail cut off, that there's this phantom limb pain, mm-hmm. in us, you know,
and that hot spot you talked about, that Irish being
twitching at the edge of consciousness, and you're creating us, you know, everything from illness to, you know, psychic disorders. Oh, you know, well, I don't know. My mother's a doctor, and my father's a doctor, but my mother's really a healer. And I just think that whatever gift she has, it came out of me in a slightly different way, but I do think it's basically the same gift. And it's to do with mediating the unconscious. I do it through words, she does it through medicine. Somebody else does it through, you know, touch. Somebody else does it through colors. Somebody else does it through dance, movement. I think that it is possible, though. Like I say, this may be only an illusion of mine, but I hope it is possible to reach some of those areas that get cut off as we grow up.
Can I ask you why you step back each time you talk about it and say, well, maybe it's an illusion? Is it because the rest of us don't acknowledge it very well, it.
Well, yeah, but I'm aware that, you know, you can't be platitudinous about things like this, and you can't be sort of, you know, you just say this is an imaginative construction. That's all right. I mean, probably everything that gets us going every day is imaginative construction. Probably all religions are imaginative constructions. Probably, you know, the fact that, you know, we have to get, you know, that life has meaning is probably imaginative construction. It doesn't matter. It'll keep us going till we die. Otherwise, we wouldn't get up in the morning. We would die, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. It's not whether this is the one all-time truth or not. It's that this construction is, well, relatively valid or relatively viable. And it's like, you know, parameter in science. It explains a lot of the phenomena, but doesn't necessarily mean that it's the final answer on the subject.
Hmm. And it is, in any case, a thick, rich universe.
Oh, yeah, and the grid is changing all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's a creative act. Human beings every day are involved in this, and I'm very, very aware of this, and I'm so overwhelmed by the sheer creativity of, you know, just human beings as they go through their day. What their inner worlds are, what they sing, they remember bits of tunes from their childhood, they talk, they make jokes. Yeah. I'm a product of the oral culture, so I'm very, very aware of this, yeah, of this going on all the time, and just how creative human beings are. I love it.
Nuala Nagano with us today on Conversations. As I said at the head of the program, she is perhaps the most celebrated Irish poet writing today. It's a privilege to welcome her to Conversations. Nuala was born in 1952, I hope I can say that, in Lancashire, and grew up in Kerry on the Dingle Peninsula in Dingle Gaeltacht.
That's right.
Gaeltacht, which means the area that speaks Gaelic or speaks Irish. Her mother and dad, both doctors, spent time in London?
No, Lancashire.
Lancashire, sorry.
Diaspora, yeah.
That's right. And then returned to Ireland with their family some years later. On this edition of Conversations, we're taking a look at language and apartheid with Nuala Nagano. I'm Susan McGinnis. I want to ask you about another thing I won't be able to quote, but I'll try and find it. There's a word in Irish, is it called Lys?
Lys, oh, a fairy fort.
Fairy fort, yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is the most common word. You also can say rah or kahir or lots of other words, but Lys is the most common word for what we know because of archaeological excavation to be the home of a strong farmer or a local chieftain any time from the Iron Age up until the late Middle Ages. They were still making them in 13th, 14th century. But at the same time, and we know this, now the rational side of our brain accepts this, but on the other hand, there's a side of us that knows that this is where the fairies live. And there's a whole folklore about encounters with the fairies in the Lys. And it's a circular image, and there are 16,000 of them out there on the Irish landscape. And even though now JCBs have kind of come into common use in Ireland, these are big earth movers, very few people would be as ungodly as to touch a Lys. Because, you know, you might, you've all know about the man who knocked down the Lys and was found dead in his bed in the morning. Mm. Or, well, it's just even more frightening. I've heard of some people who've knocked down Lys and were not found dead in their bed in the morning. And that's very worrying because it means that there's nothing is sacred anymore. But what I'm talking about, though, is that there is that this Lys out there does seem to work as a projection of an inner landscape, of something within us, probably the subconscious, and it is girded around with dangerous vibes, and I suppose if you go into the Lys and never come out, you could call that a mental breakdown. But but if you go in and come out and bring something with you, that's known as artistic creation. That's what poets do, and all sorts of artists.
You have a number of poems that go into the Lys, it seems to me. Is there one that you wouldn't mind sharing? I remember one, mm-hmm. And I don't remember the poem. I remember reading it, but not its title, about a young girl who's pregnant and who or is, oh, she may be nursing. And she...
Oh, yeah, but that doesn't have a translation with me here. No, that's still in Irish, yes. But that's based on actually a case in Ireland, the Anna Lovett case of a girl who, a young girl who was going to school, was 14, and was pregnant and in extremis, with nobody to help her, went and gave birth at a grotto, Our Lady, you know, a grotto to the Virgin Mary, in the town where she lived in Granard in County Cavan. And the whole town denied that they knew anything about this, that the nuns in school, and said that they didn't know she was pregnant. And it was this terrible case of actual, you know, something that's going on at the moment in Ireland, you know, lack of basic compassion. And I was very upset by that, and it just happened that at the time I was reading some folklore material, and I came across the story about a woman who had been brought into the list by the fairies to nurse a fairy child, and then I put the two together. I said in my story that I presume I kind of put myself in the position of that woman, and then the fairies ask, you know, would you have something to eat? And of course, even we know from the Persephone story that it's very dangerous to eat food from the other world, because then that they have a hold over you. Mm. So in my poem, I said, no, I'm on a diet. No, thank you very much. And I managed to get out again. But they say, that's all right, because we'll have somebody in your place tomorrow. There's this little girl, and we got a hold on her. And I was trying to talk, using the fairy metaphor, about the collective subconscious, about the fact that the collective subconscious was very destructive towards this girl. And for me, the image of the lists and the fairies is more than the personal subconscious. It's often the collective subconscious. And like I say, in Ireland, the idea of the individual has not really percolated up from the general communal. And it can be very, very, very dangerous. Things can happen in the collective subconscious, like great storm clouds can gather. And somebody gets to be the lightning conductor, and then lightning hits that person, and it might have very little to do with that person. Really, it's like, you know, the witch hunt thing in Salem. You know, that way all sorts of repressions and things were in the collective subconscious, and these poor unfortunate women who had epilepsy or some sort of diseases, or you know, were chosen as the lightning conductors, and the lightning hit them. So the modern versions of that are going on all over the world. I mean, you know, it's not just in Ireland. But I use the fairy and the list imagery as a metaphor for it. And actually, once I discovered that metaphor, I was really happy, because there's a huge repertoire of material on fairies. So I can talk about a lot of things and get away with saying an awful lot of things metaphorically that it would be very hard to say openly in Ireland, because we are a very sort of intense and intensely interrelated community.
You know, I was going to ask you about getting away with it. If somehow this collective unconscious to which you refer doesn't become distressed when one of its respected poets comes and says, look at this, look what happens when we feel this way, think this way, when people drop through the net.
Oh, yeah, I mean, but it works both ways. You don't become a respected poet unless you do that first. But having done that, it does mean that, you know, you can often be marked out as to be hit by lightning. Oh, yeah, it happened to me this year. The second time in my life, I was severely hit by lightning. And the first time you're hit by lightning, you say, okay, it was an accident. The second time you're hit by lightning, you say, it begs the obvious question, what is it in me that attracts lightning? And maybe that's what being a poet is, that you, there's something in you that attracts lightning.
Part of the job description, yeah, as you
exactly,
said earlier.
Yeah. Yeah, and you just hope you can manage to survive the attack or the overload of electrical energy, and you know, then and get on with your life. But that can happen, yeah.
In as much as this is not a logical exercise for you, an exercise in logic, when you go into the list as a symbolic journey, is it difficult, ever devastating, troubling for you?
To bring anything out?
Do you bring anything out?
Yeah, well, the other world, the list, the underworld, the subconscious, whatever you call it, you know, has very strict currency restrictions. And, you know, they give you gold and things in there. You wake up in the morning and you find you've got leaves in your pocket, you know. And yeah, that's always a problem. You mean, you wake up in the middle of the night, you have this great poem and you write it down, and then you wake up in the morning and the cool, clear light of dawn, and you say, well, what's that rubbish? Oh, yeah. Oh, that happens all the time. The challenge is to smuggle, to be a smuggler. I think that's really what poets are smugglers of other world good, other worldly goods into this world. And I mean, it's a full-time job, smuggling is.
Fascinating. You also talk about wrestling.
Oh, with demons, yeah. Well, I mean, the Bible has wonderful examples of that, which I mine all the time. You know, Jacob and the angel and all that stuff. Oh, yeah, I do think that that's what was going on there. That it was a major epistemological challenge going on, and Jacob wrestled with the angel, but it could have been a demon. I mean, who's to say?
Yeah.
They don't kind of come out with their passports and say, I'm a demon, I'm an angel, you know. But it's all sort of very strong and powerful, overwhelming energy. But he managed to ask, you know, to not let the angel overwhelm him. It did leave him with a gammy leg for the rest of his life, but, you know, none of us are going to come out of life in one piece anyway, are we?
No. Nuala Nagano is with us on this edition of Conversation. She lives in Dublin with her husband, who is Turkish and who is a geologist, and their four children. Your husband speaks Turkish to the children, you speak Irish to the children?
Yeah, and English still overwhelms us all. Terrible! I know, I speak Irish to them and they answer me in Turkish, or I speak Irish to them and they answer me in English, but that's not true, because ultimately when they get to be teenagers, they're competent in three languages, and then it's up to themselves. You can't live their lives for you. But I have found that all those years that I was heartbroken because they answered me in a language which wasn't Irish, and has really paid off, because now they are actually quite scathing and fluent in Irish when they need to be. So
very good.
Yeah.
Yes. Right.
That means it's a living language for them. You know, it's not just something you do to please mummy.
When I was asking you about wrestling, I was actually thinking not of demons, but of a discussion you had with someone when you were talking about muses and talking about the male energy of the muse as being something that you wrestled down if you were successful and got inside you so you could work with it, and the female energy being no delicate shrinking flower, but being something that ended up, I can't remember exactly, but it was, the battle was one of flying limbs and teeth and
skin
and bone.
Oh, yes, I do think that, I mean, I'm talking serious psychic disturbance here. No, I do think it's, when you go into the, you know, that this is, it is a dangerous, it's a dangerous journey, yeah. You may not come out. And, you know, each poem is a leap in the ocean, and sometimes you're lucky you have a kind of a conceptual sort of safety net underneath, but sometimes you haven't. And, you know, if you're lucky, you swim. If you're not lucky, you sink. That's a sort of part of the occupational hazard. But, you know, it's all right. It's still, you know, never a dull moment. It's very exciting.
Yeah, I suppose I wasn't thinking about it as negative at all, but just like any other explorer, the ocean is not calm, yes?
Mm, that's true.
Yeah. I think one of the, and this is, this will make a leap if you'll go with me. One of the things I was thinking about with muses is that what you access seems to be not only the inner life of Nuala Nagano, but also seems to be through the lists and folk stories, oral tradition, you also access what critics have talked about as the fullness of the Irish heritage. Not just.
Newton said it, you know, that when they asked, you know, how did he do so much, he said, I was standing on the shoulders of giants. I do believe that the individual, that your own individual abilities are really tiny, a drop in the ocean compared with what's in the tradition, but at the same time, the tradition has to be transmitted through the salient lines of your personality. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you are very important, the individual is very important, mover in all of this. But I find that the tradition is extraordinarily rich and wonderful and overwhelming in its wisdom. Again, you know, depending on what agenda you put on it, you know. But I think we're free to change the agendas. I don't think we should be enchanted by any particular version. Like at the turn of the century, there was a nationalist version put on the Irish myths. And that was very enabling at the time. It really helped people and it was necessary for its time. But now I think things have changed and there's no reason we should have to stick to that agenda. But the myths themselves are eternal and wonderful.
Do you think this exploration of the inner self also says something about the place Ireland is in terms of its identity in the world? Is
that Oh, yeah, because of all the sort of European people, we would be the first to admit that we're the least linear, maybe. We do. I mean, there is an extraordinary exuberance of imagination and exuberance of language and exuberance of the subconscious in Ireland. You know, the most ordinary conversations on a bus can be hilarious. In a pub, you'd hear better poetry most nights in a good pub where good conversation is going on in Irish or in English than you see in a lot of written in a lot of books. And I'm very, very, very interested in how the subconscious comes up through the spoken language in a much more spontaneous way than it does into writing, where it becomes mediated by writing even.
It is one of the chores of writing to find that spontaneity, even though.
Yeah. To try and keep the spontaneity, even though you have to transpose it into a written form. I mean, if you have a oral performance and you just write it down, transcribe it, that's not enough because, you know, you're misinterpreting it. Unless you transcribe it in a very special way where you put in the breath gaps and where you can get across all the jokes or even a tape is very good for that. But to try and get that down on the printed page, onto the permanence of the printed page, which is the printed page is very important act, is that it's permanent. To pin that down and at the same time not destroy it is for me one of the greatest challenges. And I think it's a big enough challenge that it'll keep me out of mischief until I die, you know?
So the oral tradition is from where it comes, but...
Yeah, but you just can't just transcribe it like that. You've got to you've got to transpose it into another medium, and you also have to, I think, basically... there's an alchemy that goes on in your own person, through the effect of your own personality, whereby you have to somehow change it, metamorphize it into something else. But of course, you know, that's again part of the challenge.
Mm-hmm. You said in a article, an interview, something that in workshopping poems with your students, that a good poem is maybe rewritten 50 times. Was that a number out of the air?
It was out of the air because, like I say, that Keshe na Tangan poem just came once, and it came so fast it went chung chung chung, and I left a gap. There was one word I couldn't remember the Irish for bulrushes, so I just left it out, and I looked it up afterwards in the dictionary. But it came so fast. But if I'd stopped at what's the Irish for bulrushes, which I couldn't think of just then, the dynamic of the poem would have been changed, or maybe would have evaporated. So no, and that poem, not a single word was changed. I just put in the gap that I'd left for bulrushes. Not a single word was changed there, but so, you know, so this 50 cases is not always true, but there are poems that grow by a method of accretion that may take you 7 years to write. There are other poems that you have 50 stabs at. You know, they may not be versions of the same poem, they may be complete new starts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And all of this is fodder for something else, I assume, as well.
Yeah, and you keep on doing it every day.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I asked you a minute ago to read again and then got interested in what you were saying. Would you mind?
Oh, of course.
Okay.
Well, would you like to suggest one this time?
All three of the ones I have in mind. Would you mind obeyed? Did I say
that
right?
Oh, yes. No, you did. Yes, yes.
Oh, fine. Good. All right. I should say, while Nuala is here, because you must be thinking about her books, you who are listening, there are three books of poetry in Irish, published between 1981 and 1991. The first collection of poems that emerged in English was Pharaoh's Daughter by Gallery Press in Ireland, 45 poems by Nuala Ngannou. translations by 13 distinguished poets from Ireland, thought of as a veritable who's who of Irish poetry. After that came selected poems by Raven Arts Press in Dublin, translations by Michael Harnett. Selected Poems was first published in translation in 1986 and reissued in the dual language format that all Nuala's poems now take in 1988 and in 1989. Two other publication notes, her most recent book is The Astrakhan Cloak. We've talked about this. The English translation is by Paul Muldoon. It was first published in 92 by Gallery Press. If you're looking for these books in bookstores in the United States, you'll find them, both Pharaoh's Daughter and The Astrakhan Cloak, published by Wake Forest University Press in 1993. The two came out as companion volumes. There.
Yeah, that's right.
And we'll say all this at the end of the hour as well. This poem is from Pharaoh's Daughter. Obeyed.
Yeah, and Obeyed is a mourning song. It was a common enough medieval form. The medieval Obeyeds that I've read in French and in Irish are very beautiful. And I often wake up at the crack of dawn and look out the window and see things, and basically this is what this poem is about. I was in Kerry, where we have a summer house, where I lived for 3 years at the time, when I wrote this, and that's where all the birds and stuff come from, because it is a wildlife sanctuary and very beautiful. Obeyed. It's all the same to morning, what it dawns on the bickering of jackdaws and leafy trees, on that dandy from the wetlands, the green mallard, stylish glissando among reeds, on the moorhen whose white petticoat flickers around the bog hole, on the oyster catcher on tiptoe at low tide. It's all the same to the sun what it rises on the windows in houses in Georgian squares, on bees swarming to blitz suburban gardens, on young couples yawning in unison before they do it again, on dew like sweat or tears on lilies and roses, on your bare shoulders. But it isn't all the same to us that nighttime runs out, that we must make do with today's happenings and stoop and somehow glue together the silly little shards of our lives so that our children can drink water from broken bowls, not from cupped hands. It isn't the same at all. The translation is very kindly by Michael Longley. Obad. It's Kamalishan Vadin Kadering Yalanchi. And a cog and a brain sagachran in snakreen yelogacha. A mordal glass of snav gatos the lachemas and yelkach and snakarehe. Honin bon and hirkinish gagabanisis and balpartig. A logashulga kurmach a ran of wora. His commolition grian kadere yayinchi. And the tehebrick gerinoga the glinna snit to scarre garnoga shoshacha. And the sahibacha galavuchan kracha yena vergardini bruchbalte. Ar lán ó nóg a fós a mán fach a gosiún, is fún a gúplá a gerí ní santa, ar grúch de gliscarnach na dheor a bhúra, ar lilina sa rósina, ar de gwilna. Ach ní kamalín go bhil an íhe réir hart, is go gafar glach a lepe rud a chiolhig an lán yavan tlí, go gafar imach tis cromashí sa rís, tis písí biog a brealtan da ar síl, ag lo hú le chéil ar kama égan, gan gur féidir len ar lean í, Ishka gol as bali briste in anna dasa musa, ni kama linna e. And you can hear how Michael Longley got the tone perfectly, even though he's the first to admit he hasn't a single word of Irish. So that's the sort of thing that gives me great hope that, you know, that I, in spite of the fact that I do write in a minority language, that, you know, you can radiate out into something else.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. Both of them.
Well, it's one of those quiet sort of, how will I say, meditative poems. I don't really write that many of them. I do write the odd one. I usually have a lot more, how will I say, storm and drang, you know, mm-hmm. Thunder and lightning and horse, wild horses and stuff, you know.
And humor.
Yeah, and I go for the hijinks a bit, yeah.
Yeah. Would you be willing to read Deep Freeze?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good. I was just thinking about this one. And then maybe we'll ask you to offer up a strum and drang poem and get something of the great breadth and depth here. Deep Freeze is, you'll find in the Astrakhan Cloak, poems in Irish by Nuala Nagano with translations into English by Paul Muldoon. I like this for its physical space it takes up in the kitchen and also the psychic space it takes up.
Oh, I tell you, mind. Yes. Mind you, I wrote this out of a psychic need. I was afraid that next thing I knew I was going to be found frozen inside in it myself. Oh, you know, it was just drawing me in. So I had to, you know, I had to create my form of exorcism. And also, I think Paul Muldoon did a marvelous translation of it. He gets across that sort of that slightly wacky quality that is in the original and is deliberate, you know. Deep Freeze. A modern horn of plenty, a magic coffer from which we take the best of food and drink, every comestible we might savor and no two tasting the same, a trunk of household odds and ends, a healing well that staves off our deepest hungers, it ne'er o'erbrims nor gangs dry. We adore its monumental wealth, its illimitable icy streams of milk and honey, apples and peaches, Irish stews, crinkle-cut chips, pre-ground legs of beef, batches of dessert, sweet cakes, a couple of whole sheep. Here are the 5 loaves and 2 Spanish mackerel to feed the multitude, if they ever come. And who put the dead cat in amongst the spinach? Jimmy Roy Haig, wait till I tell your mum. In the dead centre of every kitchen, it holds its own, it glumly stands its ground. These are the strains of no otherworldly musicians, but the hum of its alternating current. For here, if ever I saw one, is a fit emblem of the ditch or long barrow from which we derive, and wherein lies our fate. It chills me to the marrow that we should most truly find ourselves among its fatted and its golden calves. Deep Freeze. Cornucopia na hish and cofrin drichta sa dogamid nuagachabi agus shanakachati. Irat solashti agus dirachta veilas gan nenda hiraimacha arena vlasha. Balak slahar gach tailik, tabar slanaha ar nokras airechtuil na medin is na tean an ishk. Airmid a karn al vahasa. Ni lentura le na chlea da vairta da vil is uachtar da fechoga is ula. The Strushi ni Gaelicha, Scaloga, Caruni, Martola, and all the Vinahe, Ir Frinte, Kishtimishle, Ga Chire. Ta Kuig Veloga Rainan is Ga Iesk Fachinis Lutter Corson, Mahaganchid. Is Kaker and Kat Marav Samask and Spanashta, Jimmy Vida Hag Granat the Ledvam. Sitta Gabucha, a Grilar, Gak Kishtinach, by me and Marvefer Vonigar Shaviltachta, is yet Kultashin the Krinissa Achlinamid na Vim Sastachta, Karnini, Ahish Straha Electrische. Memento mori par excellence ma faca rivcian. Salid ufer erendiag dar dishin is gerchuhe atamid. Even a granta gacha hubla limid inte. Marav agus cruig. Is chofur leshan uig. Because it dawned on me that actually the Deep Freeze was a major icon of our society. Mm. Just like shopping mall is the cathedrals of our time to the great god Mammon, you know. And we forget that the sacred is interpenetrating the banal and domestic every day. It just occasionally you sort of get a glimpse of it, and when I get a glimpse of it, when I get that sort of light of, you know, it's kind of like a laser light of inspiration, then it lights up all the banal and domestic and makes it into something else. And that's where poems really, they're the kind of poems I'm interested in, because after all, you know, we're living in the last quarter of the 20th century, and you know, we have to make we have to make sense of our lives, with all its, with all the, you know, accoutrements of technology and everything else. Just learn how to look at it in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Deep Freeze, from the Astrakhan Cloak.
That doesn't translate sometimes. You know, for instance, in Italy, that a poem doesn't go down well at all because they don't have a deep freeze culture. They shop for fresh vegetables, fruit every day. So I have an Italian translator, and I said, will you do that one? She said, no. She said it would be meaningless in Italy. So it's funny, some poems are culturally conditioned, yeah.
That That's very interesting. The outward signs are. One more? Mm-hmm. One of your choice? You tell me.
You said, I do one of the, I don't know, oh dear, I don't have a translation, I haven't it with me. I have one about stigmata, it's a real vampire poem, but I don't have a translation with me, sorry. So I'll do a mermaid one.
Okay. These are on Xerox sheets. Is there another collection coming out?
Yeah, this is the one I'm working on. It's called the Maruach HaShimig. This is the first poem there. It's called The Mer People Who Dried Up on Land. And that's the working title. I don't know if it's going to be the one I'm going to end up with. But this first one is a sort of a framing poem for the other ones. It talks about them as a tribe and what happened to them. And all the strange diseases they got when they came up on land. They got, for instance, they could never really lose the where their gills were, so they would be feeling embarrassed about it. So they used to wear necklaces and things to cover it, and then they would have skin diseases and things because they weren't used to not having water around them. And for instance, they got terrible sunburn and they got moonburn even, and they went blue in the moon. I started off, you know, the sky's the limit. So I had great fun with this metaphor in general. But that is the overall framing poem. And then I have individual ones about different members of this tribe. And this is one of them, on Ruach Snos Bedale, the mermaid in hospital. Again, it goes back to this idea of to change your language is as deep trauma and as deep an invasion of your psychic space as to change your body image. Yeah. And I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, how the hell do I, you know, you make this dramatic, how the hell do you catch your reader? Because they're all really tricks up your sleeve. I mean, you have to do that. You have to sort of make the words jump off the page. And you know, what kind of a dramatic situation will I do? Will I create? And I happened to be reading a book, called A Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Yeah. It's a wonderful book. By Dr. Oliver Sacks, I think his name is, an American neurologist who has studied people who have lesions in their brain. And one of, for instance, the lesions that somebody had was that they lost their body image. And so they woke up in the hospital and they found this leg in the bed with them. And they thought, what's this dead leg doing in the bed with me? And they threw it out of the bed. They didn't realize it was their own leg. And I thought, wow, there's my mermaid. Yeah. So this is a rough translation by myself, yet it's not a real proper translation in English. The Mermaid in Hospital. She woke, and when she looked for her fishtail, there it was, gone. Inside in the bed with her were these two long, cold yolks. You'd swear they were switches of kelp or sides of meat. They must be cutting me, New Year's Eve, half the stuff out of their minds on drink, and the other half a shower of practical jokers. But come here, this is going a wee bit far. And with that, she fired the pair of them out of the room. But here's the bit she can't understand. Out of the bed she flew right after them, cocks and bowhead. What were those two yokes to her? And what had she to do with them? The nurse, it was, tipped her the wink, told her what the score was. That's a leg you have tied to you there, and another one there beside below it. One leg, two legs, one and two. Now you must learn what they can do. In the long months that followed, you'd wonder, did her instep ever fail her? Did her heart fall as her arches fell? Some of that is based actually on other facts. For instance, my mother actually went to hospital when I was very small, and she had TB of the spine. And then she was 2 years in bed, and when she bedridden, and when she got up, she couldn't walk. Her arches had fallen, and she always impressed upon us as small children just how painful a thing it is, and how awful it was to have to learn to walk again. Yeah. The most basic thing that you think you do so naturally, like walking, was with her a learnt activity, you know, in her adult years. And I remember being very struck by that as a child. So that's where I got the sort of bit at the end, the sad bit. Gushishi is near a herbal ash gown nismo. A castig se labele, viandar rod father forsa. Bogolath could guide vara eed no slamaki fiola. Mar vagatash eed niflar, ehen a kadamore. The lahan irin nasamar la duchess and la elekar or hook of the jokana. Marshin Hain is Lauren Major, with a chashi and dorad, a machas and shomra. Akshahi and chid, not thiggenchi. Con is a hitchy fain and a near cox and bowhead. Can the winter be again dorad lay? The can winter be kelosan. And vanaltra a hook and nodde, is a hurry a dro an olish. Cos si sha at a kangle to deeth, agus can elica and sahis foot. Cos, cos ella, a hain, a do. Gahatu falum, conus shulo. In snemis of other a lan, nether a hit a cree, derer mar a hit, throck na cushite, a horse she.
Look for a collection of poems coming out sometime soon.
I hope, yeah.
Working title?
The Mermaids, the Moruiga Hrimig, the mer people who dried up on land is. Or something to that effect.
Or something close. A next volume of poetry by Nora Nagano. Look also for an article, an essay in the New York Times Magazine sometime in 1995 on what it's like to write in a minority language by Nora Nagano. Nora, thank you so much. It's been a wonderful hour.
Thank you.
I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations. Thank you for joining us. I hope you join me again next week.